16. Aga shut the door behind her, clutching her handbag and the biscuit tin to her chest as if they might be snatched away at any moment. On the landing outside the detective's premises, a heavily made-up old woman studied her with sly, knowing eyes, while enveloping herself in a haze of silver-blue cigarette smoke. She said nothing, but the look on her face conveyed both accusation and bored indifference, as if she had witnessed every possible sin in the world and had long since ceased to be shocked by any of them. Her attention flicked momentarily to the tin Aga was holding so protectively. Then her eyes lost focus, and whatever gleam of malice had been there a moment before. Aga was about to take the stairs down to the next landing when she noticed that another woman, this one young, with very black hair held back from her face with a spotted red headscarf, was on her hands and knees, waxing and polishing the lower steps. The woman looked up as Aga was about to descend. "Please," she said, nodding towards the black iron framework of the elevator shaft that rose up the center of the stairwell. Grateful that the elevator car was ready and waiting, Aga stepped inside and slid shut the trellised gate, then pressed the button for the ground floor. With a thud and a whine, the elevator began its inching descent, creeping past the cleaning girl. The elevator descended another floor, and then came to an abrupt rattling halt, exactly between landings. Aga swore and pressed the button again, but the elevator refused to budge. She tried forcing open the sliding gate, but it had locked itself tight. "Hey," she called out, "can someone help me? I'm stuck in this thing." She heard the cleaning girl say something, but it sounded more sympathetic than useful. Aga tried the elevator button again, but with no more effect than before. Feeling suddenly dejected, it began to dawn on her that she might be stuck inside it for hours while some overworked engineer made his grumbling way across the city on a Saturday. Assuming anyone had the presence of mind to call for assistance, which might be one assumption too many, she called out again. If the cleaning girl didn't answer or understand her, then perhaps she might be able to rouse Floyd. But this time she heard nothing at all in reply. A minute passed with no further sign of movement. All she could hear was the sound of her own breathing, and the occasional metallic rattle as her movements caused the elevator car to chafe against its restraints. The building sounded utterly deserted. She heard a door shut somewhere above her, followed by a rapid succession of descending footsteps. The footsteps quickened in pace and then became thuds, as if someone was skipping two or three steps at a time. Aga peered through the meshwork screen that constituted the elevator car's roof and saw a dark figure circle the landing immediately above her. Before she could call out, the figure had bounded down the steps surrounding the part of the shaft in which she was stuck in a series of flighty jumps and was on the landing below, continuing towards street level. Aga had only seen the figure in full view for an instant, and that blurred by motion, but she had not been able to make out any facial details. The figure was wearing a high-collared coat, a fedora jammed low on his head, with the brim turned down. For an absurd moment, she wondered if it might have been Floyd, but even as the idea occurred to her, she dismissed it as stupid. A moment later, the elevator buzzed back into life and resumed its descent. It came to a halt on the next landing, and not wanting to take any further chances, Aga opened the gate and made the rest of her journey on foot. With the box still in her possession, it was a relief to reach daylight. Somehow she felt safer outdoors, illogical as that may have been. She looked up and down Rue du Dragon, but there was no sign of the running man, or of anything else obviously out of place. The street was as quiet and sleepy as it had been when she had arrived, but there were some pedestrians walking along it, and if anyone was to try anything against her, she knew she could count on one or two witnesses from the equine butcher's shop on the ground floor of Floyd's building. A little further down the street, Aga stepped into the doorway of a boarded-up hosier's shop, long out of business, and snapped the lid from the tin. Inside, as Floyd had shown her in the office, was a thick rubber-banded bundle of paperwork and documents. She took this bundle and stuffed it into her handbag. Having no further use for the tin, she pushed it into a pile of cardboard boxes and other debris that had built up in one corner of the shop doorway. She stepped back into the street and walked to the south end of Rue du Dragon, crossing Rue de Sèvres, on to the much wider thoroughfare of Rue de Rennes. As she reached the corner, she heard the rumble of a car starting somewhere behind her, and as she walked north on Rue de Rennes, She risked a glance over her shoulder and saw the grilled nose of the vehicle emerging onto the same street. The car rolled forward until the cab was in full view, but the sunlight flaring from the windscreen prevented her from making out the driver. Auger quickened her pace, and when she allowed herself another glance back, there was no sign of the car. But there were many similar cars parked along the roadside, and it would not have been difficult for the driver to lose his amongst them. Auger continued along Rue de Rennes, stopping every now and then to try to flag down a taxi. But either it was the wrong time of day, or there was some Parisian knack she hadn't yet grasped, for the taxi sped on in an indifferent blur of black metal and chrome, leaving her muttering under her breath. Auger glanced back once more and thought she saw the same car again, inching along at walking pace. But no sooner had her suspicions begun to build than the car swerved away down a side street. Auger told herself sternly that she was being just as paranoid as Susan White's fictitious persona. The trick was to see things from Floyd's point of view, not hers. The detective could have no possible idea of the significance of the paperwork in the box. Her story was entirely reasonable, and Floyd should have no grounds to doubt her word. Susan White had even mentioned that her sister would be coming for her belongings. Still nervous, but forcing herself to act a little more calmly, Auger realized that she had arrived at the entrance to the metro station at Saint-Germain-des-Prés. She would have preferred the speed and safety of a taxi ride, but the train was the next best thing. She fished money from her purse, still not completely familiar with the coinage, and bought a one-way ticket. A train was grinding into the underground station as she cleared the turnstile. Auger got aboard, moving along the compartment as the doors closed themselves and the train lurched away. She found a seat next to two young women who had their faces buried in fashion magazines. The train burrowed its way south, slowing into Saint-Sulpice, the station's walls plastered with faded sepia-tinted advertisements for perfume, stockings, and tobacco. As people moved on and off the train, Auger checked them out in her peripheral vision, searching for anyone who looked like Floyd or the figure she had seen descending the stairs. But she recognized no one, and as the train pulled away into the darkness of the next tunnel, she allowed herself to relax a notch. After a minute or so, the train slowed into the next station on the line, Saint-Placide, and Auger once again kept an eye on the passengers coming and going. This time, however, it was with less apprehension and more a guarded interest in the private lives of these unwitting prisoners. It was then that Auger noticed a woman stepping out of the train two carriages ahead of the one she was in. The woman had a pretty face framed by very black hair, and it took Auger a moment to place her as the girl who had been cleaning the stairs in Rue du Dragon. She had removed her headscarf and apron, but her features were unmistakable. Rather than heading for the exit, the woman walked alongside the train until she reached the carriage next to Auger's, reboarding just as the doors hissed shut and the train hurtled back into darkness. Auger clutched the handbag tightly against her stomach, resisting the urge to open it to make sure that the paperwork was still safe and sound. Presently, the train began to slow into Montparnasse. Auger made sure she was standing right next to the door as the train pulled to a stop, and was relieved when a surge of people followed her from the train, enveloping and jostling her towards the tiled corridors and stairs that led to the number 6 line. She pushed ahead of them, all the while clutching her handbag against her like a living thing that needed protection. Climbing stairs, she glanced back and saw the black-haired woman behind her, but almost lost amongst the faces and hats of the other passengers. The number 6 line ran on an elevated section of track, and when Auger reached daylight, she was relieved to see that a train was already in the station, on the point of departure. She ran for it, nearly tripping in her painfully tight shoes, and just managed to get aboard as the doors slid shut. As the train pulled away and Auger caught her breath, she saw the black-haired woman still waiting on the platform. Auger checked her watch. It was just before 10. Barely an hour had passed since she had walked into the detective's office. Floyd picked up the telephone on the first ring. "Greta?" "It's me," she confirmed, sounding a little out of breath. "I lost her," Floyd said. He was sitting in the sad, shuttered spare room in Montparnasse. Sophie was upstairs with Marguerite, and the house had a peculiar kind of Sunday morning calm about it, even though it was only Saturday. "I expected her to get into a taxi as soon as she left the office, but she was on foot and there was no way I could keep up with her in the car without her getting suspicious. I don't think she recognized me, but I wasn't going to take any chances. Better to lose her this time, and hope we can pick her up again near Blanchard's apartment.
You think she'll go back there?
She might have unfinished business, especially when she gets a look at what's inside the box.
Maybe she will. In any case, we haven't lost her yet. I know where she's staying.
Floyd brightened. Now and then a piece of unexpected good fortune dropped into his hands like an early Christmas present. You managed to keep up with her?
Not exactly, Greta said. I followed her on foot until she reached the station at Saint-Germain. I skulked in the shadows while she bought a ticket, then bought one for myself while she headed for the train. I got on the same train as she did, but made sure I wasn't in the same carriage. I moved up the train at Saint-Placide, then followed her as she changed onto the number 6 line at Montparnasse. Luckily, I know that station pretty well. I spent most of my childhood changing trains there. I saw the direction she was taking, but she managed to get onto a train before I reached the platform.
Then you lost her?
Only for a couple of minutes. I caught the next train out of Montparnasse. We were on the elevated line moving west, and you have a good view of the street from those elevated stations, so I kept my eyes peeled. It paid off. I saw her walking away from the station at Duplis, just as we were slowing down. I got off the train, heard down the steps, and followed her all the way home, always hanging a block behind her.
I'm impressed, Floyd said. Did she look as though she thought she was being followed?
I'm not a mind reader, Floyd, but she seemed a lot less twitchy than before. My guess is she thought the change of trains had thrown anyone following her off her scent.
I'll make a detective out of you one of these days, just you watch. Floyd reached for his notebook and pen. Tell me where she's staying.
Greta gave him the address of a hotel on Avenue Emile Zola, a short walk from Duplessis metro station. She was calling from a brasserie frequented by change-of-shift car workers from the nearby Citroën factory. I can't tell you her room number, or how she likes her toast done, and they can't stay here all day either.
You don't have to. I can be there within the hour.
There's no way you can get here sooner?
I'll have someone on my tail as well, remember, Floyd said.
Another of those horrible children?
She asked, nervousness creeping into her voice. No, just Belliard's goons. They followed me to Montparnasse. I think I can lose them if I cross the river twice, but that will take time. I don't want them thinking I'm taking an interest in Verity Auger. If they do, awkward questions might be asked.
What do you mean, awkward questions?
The kind that will involve a heavy dental bill.
Be here as soon as you can. This is as far into this as I want to go, Floyd. I never had aspirations to play the girl detective, and I'm not on your payroll.
You did a good job, Floyd said as she hung up. He set his receiver down and began to plot his route across Paris, incorporating as many sudden turns and reversals as he dared. Auger turned the key, locking the door from inside, and crashed onto the bed, suddenly overwhelmed by relief and exhaustion. She closed her eyes for a few minutes, then hauled herself to the pea-green wash basin and splashed some cold water onto her face.
"Stay sharp," she said aloud.
"The hard part might be over, but you still need to make it back to the portal. Don't get too complacent, Auger, and don't talk to yourself either. It's the first sign of madness." She removed her horrid, tight Parisian shoes and dialed down to the front desk for a pot of coffee. Then she called down to the lobby again and asked to be connected to an external number.
"Just a moment, madame."
Someone picked up on the third ring, answering in poorly enunciated French.
"To whom am I speaking?"
"This is Auger," she said.
"Good," Aveling answered, slipping immediately back into English. "Do you have?"
"Yes, I have the items. Can you get a message through to Caliscan?"
"Not possible, I'm afraid."
He was speaking from the safe house, a rented room a minute's walk from Cardinal Lemoine. No direct telephone connection existed between the surface of Paris and the concealed chambers underground.
"We're having some technical difficulties with the link."
"Tell me it isn't serious."
"It's being worked on. It's not the first time the link has become unstable, and it'll most likely sort itself out within a few hours. It's probably not related."
"Not related to what?"
"Anything you need worry about."
"Tell me, you patronizing..." She tried to insult him, dredging her repertoire for something suitably nasty,
but it was as if a mental roadblock had been installed between her brain and her mouth.
"There's political trouble back home,"
Aveling interjected before she could continue.
"That slasher offensive everyone was expecting? It's begun. But don't you fret. Just bring the box and let us worry about the bigger picture. We're all very happy with the way you've handled things so far. It would be a shame to spoil things now, wouldn't it?"
"I could just burn the papers," Auger said, "or throw them away somewhere where no one will ever find them. What's the problem with that?"
"We'd rather you returned them to us. That way we can make sure nothing has gone astray."
"I can make it to the portal," she said, "but I'm not certain that's such a great idea at the moment. I'm pretty sure someone followed me here, from the detective's office."
"What kind of someone?"
"Someone working for him, I think. He seemed very willing to hand over the box. With hindsight, it looks as though he always intended to have someone tail me."
"And he's just a local detective?"
"Yes, the one I told you about after I spoke to Blanchard."
"He's probably just curious. Do your best to shake him off your tail, but don't worry about him."
"There's more going on here than you've told me," she said.
"Listen carefully," Aveling said. "It's exactly 10:40 now. Check your watch and synchronize."
"Done."
"At exactly noon, we will arrange for a 2-minute power interruption on the metro line running through Cardinal Lemoine. I'll be waiting for you inside the tunnel at the door. And for obvious reasons, it would not be good to be late. No excuses, Auger. We're all counting on you. I'll see you in 80 minutes with the paperwork."
She said nothing.
"Will you be there?" Aveling asked.
"Yes," she said. "Of course I'll be there."
Room service arrived with a knock on the door. She hung up on Aveling and opened the door as far as the security chain allowed, before letting the boy enter and place her coffee service on the bedside table. She tipped him generously and then locked and chained the door from the inside. The coffee was on the lukewarm side of hot, but it was considerably better than nothing. She spooned cream and sugar into it and had drunk half a cup before she began to feel calm again. She was definitely not being told everything. Auger supposed that this suspicion had always been lurking at the back of her mind, but now she was certain of it. And there was something else, something even more troubling, that had been nagging at her quietly since she had first learned of Susan White's involvement in this whole business. Why had White made such a point of involving Auger when they were little more than professional acquaintances? Auger could understand White being concerned about her own safety and wanting to make sure that the papers didn't fall into the wrong hands. She could understand the requirement for someone from the other side of the portal to come and retrieve them. But why Auger, specifically? Sure, she had the necessary background on Paris, the deep knowledge of the city, but there had to be more to it than that. At first glance, it looked as if White was playing a posthumous trick on Auger, setting her up for a hazardous job out of professional spite. But they'd been cool rivals, rather than enemies, with no mutual animosity that Auger was aware of. In truth, they were rather alike. So it had to have been something else. White was clever and calculating. She'd have done nothing without an excellent reason. And the only explanation Auger could come up with, the only one that seemed plausible to her, given what she knew of the woman, was that it was a matter of trust. Auger was an outsider. She had ties to Calascan. That was unavoidable for anyone with an antiquities background. But they weren't exactly thick as thieves. More important was the fact that she was not part of Aveling's operation. A little more than a week ago, she'd had no knowledge of E2 whatsoever, which meant, presumably, that Susan White had decided that she couldn't trust Aveling or his people. All of them? Auger wondered. Or did she just suspect that somewhere in the organization there was someone who couldn't be trusted? Auger preferred the second hypothesis. It made more sense to her than the idea that the entire organization, from Phobos to E2, was compromised. If that was the case, then they would surely have found a way to avoid bringing in an outsider, no matter how much it inconvenienced their plans. Auger thought about what she had already learned for herself. Everyone agreed that there was something important about those papers. Susan White had gone to the trouble of passing them on for safekeeping and making arrangements for their return to the other side of the portal. Calascan, Aveling, and all the others involved in the Phobos operation seemed to agree on the significance of the documents, or else Auger would never have been co-opted to retrieve them. And there was someone else who considered them to be significant.
Whoever had killed White and now Blanchard. Whoever that was, they seemed less than keen to see those papers returned to Phobos. Which implied, unless Orga's imagination was running away with itself, that the person or persons who had committed those two murders were in some way linked to the contents of the papers. Which brought her to the papers themselves. What did they have to say on the subject? Orga took the bundle of documents from her handbag and began to arrange them on the maroon bedspread, eventually covering it completely. She laid each item out neatly, but imposed no sorting methodology on the papers other than the order in which they emerged from the bundle. She stepped back from the bed and looked at the dead woman's legacy. "Talk to me, Susan," she said. "Give me a hint as to what all this is about." Orga poured herself another cup of coffee, added cream and sugar, and set about rearranging the material on the bed, hunting for some meaningful combination. But no permutation of the papers looked any more or less significant than the last. Unless she was missing something subtle, the message must be in the contents of the documents rather than any pattern they formed. None of these papers would have had any particular significance to a local. They might have struck someone as rather an eccentric collection of documents, especially if they had been traced to a young American tourist, but there was no smoking gun, no one document that shrieked of an otherworldly origin. There was, in fact, nothing in the collection that could not have been acquired by an ordinary person with access to the usual libraries and bookshops. There were no top-secret blueprints or duplicated documents from E1, nothing even remotely hinting that Susan White was an explorer who had arrived in Paris through a quasi-wormhole link from some unguessable distant part of the Milky Way. Orga scrutinized the papers once more to make sure she was not missing something. But barring the use of invisible inks, microdots, or some other such subterfuge, there was nothing intrinsically destabilizing about any of the items Susan White had acquired. There was, in short, nothing that would have caused any obvious difficulties had it fallen into local hands. In all likelihood, the documents would have been thrown out, and the biscuit tin kept instead. But Caliscan and his organization had staged a high-risk operation to recover these documents, and the emphasis had indeed been on recovering them. There had been no talk of simply discarding or destroying them. No, Caliscan wanted them back, and that meant that the documents were themselves suspected of being important. They knew that Susan White had been on to something. They just hadn't wanted to tell Orga, knowing that it might have scared her off. She had been foolish not to ask more questions about the significance of the lost property before she agreed to recover it. But Caliscan and his people had counted on her clutching at any straw to avoid the disciplinary tribunal, and they must have known that she would not think too deeply beyond the immediate objective. The fact that they had been right, that she had played so willingly into their scheme, only made her feel more foolish. "Verity," she chided herself, "you silly, silly girl." Shaking her head, Orga returned her attention to the papers. "You knew what this was about," she said, addressing Susan White's imagined presence, which she pictured brooding like herself over the tableau of harmless documents. "You knew what this was about, and you knew that it was worth someone murdering you for." Orga reached out and examined the largest of the maps. It was the first time she had paid proper attention to it. Why had it ended up in the woman's collection of papers, when others like it could be bought cheaply at almost any stationery shop? A similar map was almost certainly amongst the items White had already passed through the portal. Orga opened the map fully, laying it gently over the other documents without disturbing them. Covering half the bedspread was a political and geographical map of Europe, with lines marked on it in a dark blue ink. Orga scratched gently at the lines with her fingernail, as Floyd had done, satisfying herself that they were not part of the original design. They formed a tilted L shape, with one arm reaching from Paris to Berlin and the other from Paris to Milan. Inked circles surrounded the three cities, and neat digits above the lines indicated, Orga was certain, the distances between them in kilometers. But beyond this observation, the meaning of the markings eluded her. What was so critical about the distances between these cities that this map had to be smuggled out of E2 at all costs, when that information was readily available in the archives back home? Orga folded the map, taking pains not to damage the thin paper upon which it was printed. As she returned it to its place amongst the other documents, her attention was drawn to a railway ticket, It was for an overnight sleeper train to Berlin, purchased not long before Susan White died, but dated for travel just after her death. Olga scanned the other documents looking for a German or Italian connection. It did not take her long to find an official-looking letter from a heavy engineering concern located in a suburb of Berlin. The letter was printed on very good paper, with an impressive letterhead in scarlet ink. Her newly installed German crunched through the text with machine-like efficiency. The letter was in response to an earlier query, evidently part of some longer chain of correspondence, concerning the manufacture of a number of specialized items. From what Orga could gather, this contract involved the forging and machining of three large metal spheres at the Berlin Works of Caspar Metals. The letter also referred to the transportation and installation of these aluminium spheres in Berlin, Paris, and Milan, together with a number of associated parts. The fact that the spheres were large and heavy was obvious from the attention that the letter placed on their delivery. They would require specialized arrangements and were much too heavy to be flown, even given the distances involved. The letter went on to stress the difficulty of delivering the objects without damage, according to the instructions of the artist, and that this would incur additional costs. Metal spheres. What, she wondered, was that all about? Olga searched through the other documents and pieces of paper, looking now for anything related to the German contract. Almost immediately she found a carefully executed sketch of a sphere hanging from a heavy-duty gantry or support cradle, attached to it by many delicate springs or wires. The sphere was marked as being more than 3 meters in diameter. Olga wished that she had access to the historical archives back in E1. Although they were not exhaustive, they would have given her some guidance as to whether the spherical objects were also part of the E1 historical timeline. Perhaps some ambitious artist had indeed commissioned the forging of such aluminium spheres, and Susan White had simply got the wrong end of an innocent stick. Olga couldn't count on it, but a detail like that might just have survived the forgetting. But even if that was the case, Olga reminded herself, this was E2, where the timeline had already swerved 20 years away from E1 chronology. The chances of an artist pursuing the same project in two very different histories were small indeed. The same thinking applied even if the spheres were part of some clandestine military or scientific project being conducted by the E2 locals. Even if it had a traceable analogue in E1, it was very unlikely that a similar initiative would have been undertaken in the altered Europe of E2. But not, she had to admit, unthinkable. If there was a good enough strategic reason for something, then it might crop up in both the E1 and E2 chronologies, despite the altered political landscape. What seemed less likely was that something would be developed in E2 and not E1, especially if that something depended on a scientific underpinning. The scientific worldview of E2 had barely advanced since 1939. There was, Olga realized, a more troubling possibility. The project Susan White had uncovered might not have anything to do with the locals at all. In which case, who was running it, and what were they planning to do? She didn't have an answer yet, or even the beginnings of one, but she did have the sense that she was on the right track. She could almost feel Susan White's ghost nodding in frustrated encouragement, desperately willing her to make the next and incredibly obvious deductive leap. But Olga couldn't do that, not yet. She looked at her watch. It was nearly 11, which gave her just over an hour to make it to the Metzko tunnel before the juice was cut. Hastily, but with care, she gathered the documents, wrapped them in a sheet of writing paper from the desk, and returned them to her handbag. She would have liked the time to look at all the other things in detail, but she didn't have that luxury. And with Aveling's warnings about the unreliability of the link, Olga was more than anxious to make a safe return to the other side. As much as this living memory of Paris entranced her, as much as she longed for all the time in the world to explore it, she did not want to become its prisoner. Olga pulled aside the filmy net curtains covering the window. Since she had returned to the hotel, it had started raining, a soft October rain that muffled the city's sounds to a muted hiss of late morning traffic. She stood there for a moment and watched the pedestrians below, scurrying along under dark umbrellas and glossy raincoats. It was impossible not to see them as living beings with their own interior lives, yet their very existence was still a kind of sham. Skelskar had spoken of this world being like a photographic exposure, a snapshot of a moment in time that had, for reasons unclear, continued to evolve forward in time from that instant, while preserved in the armored shell of the ALS. There was no guessing the means by which that snapshot had been taken, or whether anyone alive on the real Earth had felt the slightest hint that it was happening, the smallest interruption in their thoughts, the merest instant of collective déjà vu. Perhaps the event had gone completely unnoticed. But thereafter, the two histories had diverged. The real counterparts of the people moving around in E2 had gone on to live out genuine flesh-and-blood lives in the historical timeline of the real E1. The snapshot could not have been taken later than May 1940, nor could it have been taken very much earlier than that, for events in E2 leading up to the Ardennes advance seemed more or less to follow the E1 timeline. The real world, E1, had shortly thereafter been plunged into a catastrophic war. Many of those who had been alive at the instant the snapshot was taken would certainly have died during that war, or during the miserable, conflict-filled decades that followed. Even if they had somehow slipped through the historical cracks and avoided death by war, or famine, or political oppression, then many of them would have lived lives blighted and lessened by the brutal circumstances of those years. And yet, as grim as those lives might have been, as squalid and miserable and tragic, they had been played out according to the right script. It was the lives of their counterparts on E2 that had followed a deviant path, and almost everyone born on E2 since the timelines diverged would either not have existed at all on E1, or would have been very different people. In every sense, they were living on borrowed time, and not just on it, but in it. For a moment, a repugnant idea flashed through Augur's mind. How much simpler would it be, how much neater, if these lives had never happened, if the snapshot had preserved only Paris and the rest of the world, but not the people in it? If it had been like one of those 19th-century photographs of the city, the exposure necessarily so long that the people blurred themselves out of existence, leaving only spectral traces. The thought made her shiver, but she could not quite erase it from her mind. Glancing at her watch, she gathered her coat and left the hotel room. As she teetered out through the lobby, still not quite steady on her heels, the concierge raised an eyebrow. But the telephone on his desk chose that moment to ring, and by the time he answered it, he had forgotten all about the awkward American woman and the hurry she seemed to be in. 17. At the metro station on Rue Cardinal Lemoine, Augur bought a one-way ticket and entered the midday crush of passengers. People took lunch seriously in Paris and thought nothing of crossing half the city to meet with a colleague, partner, or lover in some well-regarded brasserie or restaurant. Augur could not be certain whether or not she had been tailed from the hotel on Emile Zola, but she took every advantage of the flood of travellers to make herself difficult to follow, jostling her way through the crowds and racing up and down stairs and escalators in an effort to shake off any pursuer. Even so, when she reached the underground platform, she slowed her progress and let the waiting train whisk away without her. The platform was not quite deserted once the train had left, but that would be too much to hope for. There were always people who seemed to have nothing better to do than loiter in metro stations, oblivious to the passage of the trains and the urgent schedules of the other commuters. A young man in a checked jacket and flat cap was reading the racing news, a cigarette balanced on the edge of his lower lip. A plump but pretty young woman was attending to her makeup with the aid of a little brass mirror, her expression a pout of absolute concentration. Augur looked at her watch again, anxious to get the next part over with. But it was still a couple of minutes to noon, and the electricity in the rails would not yet have been turned off. She pressed her handbag closer to her, observing the slow drift of new passengers onto the platform. She had moved to the very limit of the platform, where the rails disappeared into the darkness of the tunnel. At 1 minute to noon, she saw the lights of another train pick out the rails, snaking out of the tunnel at the other end of the platform, and then the train arrived in a commotion of brakes and wheels. She looked at her watch again, willing the train to depart. The last thing she needed was for the train to get stuck in the tunnel between the station and her entry point. The train moved off. It was very nearly noon. A few more people arrived on the platform, and then the hand on her watch said it was time to go. There was no visible change in the condition of the rails, but she had no intention of touching them to test Aveling's attentiveness. She would know soon enough if he had done his job.
Auger made her move as quickly as she dared. In one fluid movement, she knelt on the edge of the platform, swung her legs over, and then lowered herself onto the grimy concrete upon which the rails were laid. Her hands were already filthy with soot and oil, and doubtless her rump was covered in the same black dirt. It didn't matter. If all went according to plan, she would never emerge from this tunnel again, and there would be no one to wonder why a smartly dressed young woman had allowed herself to get into such a state. Someone cried out. She looked back in time to see the man with the racing paper raise a hand towards her, the cigarette dropping from his lip, while the plump girl lowered her mirror to see what all the fuss was about. But by then Auger had slipped into the concealing darkness of the tunnel, keeping the wall to her left and the closest rail to her right. Once she had gone more than a few meters into the tunnel, she knew that no one would be able to see her. Unfortunately, she could also see very little ahead of her, and this time she didn't have the brightness of the station to guide her. Moving as quickly as she could, Auger kept her back to the wall for support and walked crab fashion into the blackness, trying not to think about the mice and rats that were undoubtedly scurrying near her feet or the lethal voltage that might still be coursing through the rails. She had about 100 meters to cover and rather less than 2 minutes in which to do it. Something shone in the darkness ahead of her, a blood-red light, very dim but moving. For a horrifying moment, she thought it was a train approaching her through the tunnel, even though any trains should have arrived from behind, not ahead of her. Then her sense of perspective shifted, and she realized that the light was a torch being shone in her direction by someone further down the tunnel.
"Hurry, Auger!" she heard a voice call out. "The juice has to come on again in 30 seconds, and the trains will be moving not long after that."
"Aveling?"
"Keep moving," he said in reply. "We really don't have much time."
"I think a man saw me go into the tunnel."
"Don't worry about him."
As she moved forward, the red light gradually grew brighter. Very faintly, she began to make out the dark outline of a figure crouched close to the wall. It seemed much further away than she had been expecting. Voices carried very well down the tunnel.
"Move, Auger," he hissed.
"I'm doing my best."
"Good. Don't trip now, because the rails are electrified."
"You didn't have to tell me that. If anything, it's even more likely to make me trip."
"You have the goods."
"Yes," she said, clenching her teeth. "I have the goods."
As she picked her way forward, the figure with the torch gradually became clearer, and now that her eyes were becoming better adapted to the dark, she could make out a gap in the wall immediately next to him.
"Hurry now. We're picking up a current draw on the line."
"Meaning what?"
"The trains are already running again. They won't waste much time after an intermittent fault, not during the midday rush."
At last, Auger could see the outline of Aveling's features. She sped up for the final dozen meters, grasping for the sanctuary of that dark gap in the wall.
"I think I see a train entering Cardinal Lemoine," Aveling warned.
"I'm nearly there."
"Train's moving again. Hurry up, Auger. I'm not standing here for much longer."
With little attempt to preserve her dignity, he pushed Auger through the crack in the wall, into the darkness beyond. The squeal of the approaching train grew louder, reverberating off the tunnel walls.
"Help me with this door," Aveling said. "We have to get it back into place."
He guided her hands onto the old wooden door, and she felt it shift under the pressure they were applying. The door crunched back into place at the last moment, with the lights of the train shining through the narrowing gap.
"That was close," Aveling said.
"Do you think anyone on the train saw us?"
"No."
"What about the man on the platform?"
She described him briefly.
"Like I said, don't worry about him. He's a confidence trickster. Spends all his days on that station snooping for victims. He won't be reporting anything to the authorities."
He turned off the red torch, then immediately switched on a much brighter white one. Auger squinted against the sudden glare, recognizing the cramped and filthy gullet of the access tunnel.
"I repeat, you have the goods?"
"Yes," she said wearily, "like I already told you."
"Good. I was beginning to worry that you weren't going to complete your mission. I'm glad to see you have decided to act sensibly. Give me the papers."
"They're safe with me."
"I said give them to me, Auger."
Before she could argue, he snatched her bag and flashed the torch on the bundle of documents within.
"It doesn't look like much, does it? Not for all the trouble you've gone to."
He pulled the papers out and returned the bag to her. She thought about Susan White's likely suspicion that there was someone on the team who couldn't be trusted. Maybe it was Aveling. Maybe it wasn't. But as long as Auger kept the papers in sight,
She reckoned that no immediate harm could come to them. All she had to do was ensure that they made it back to Kalaskan.
I don't know what any of this is about, Aveling. Right now, I'm not even sure I want to know. Can we just get this over with?
You won't be able to return just yet, he said. We're still having some difficulties with the link.
Another train rumbled through the nearby tunnel, the vibration of its passage dislodging dust from the ceiling of the access shaft.
Due to the temporary problem you said would be fixed by now.
It's proving to be a little less temporary than we were hoping.
Aveling stopped and shone the torch ahead of them, aiming the beam along the gentle curve of the shaft.
Augur saw his frown. What's wrong? She asked.
Nothing. I just thought I heard something.
Probably one of your own people at the portal end, Augur suggested. Aveling unzipped his jacket and slid the papers snugly inside.
Come on, let's move on.
Augur couldn't help noticing that he had slipped an automatic out of his jacket at the same time as he hid the papers. The locally made weapon gleamed an oily blue in the torchlight.
I saw something move, Augur said suddenly,
dropping her voice to a whisper. The torch beam skittered ahead of them like a nervous animal.
Where?
Down the tunnel. Looked like a person, crouching against the wall. She caught her breath, then added, It almost looked like a child.
A child? Don't be silly.
A child could easily have found their way down here.
Aveling shook his head, but she could see that he was rattled. She didn't blame him. She had not enjoyed her previous journey along this tunnel, and she certainly wasn't enjoying this one.
Is anyone there? Aveling called. Anyone from the portal? Barton! Is that you?
It wasn't Barton, Augur said, or Skelsgard either.
Aveling fired off a warning shot. The muzzle of the automatic spat orange flame into darkness, the bullets crunching through rock a dozen meters ahead of them. After the report of the gun had faded, echoes marching up and down the shaft for a few tense moments, there was only silence and their own breathing.
Damn,
Aveling said.
You saw something.
I think I saw something. But maybe it was just you planting the suggestion in my head.
You heard something before I saw the child, Augur pointed out.
I thought I saw something as well,
Aveling said, sounding a good deal less sure of himself.
Something like a child?
It wasn't a child. If it was a child, then there was something badly.
But he left the remark uncompleted.
Something's not right here, Augur said.
She pressed him against the wall, silencing him with a hiss.
You know it. We're just seeing shadows.
Or something's gone wrong. I know what I saw. I wasn't imagining it, even if you think you were.
He answered her with a hiss of his own, all the while aiming the muzzle of the automatic along the shaft. She noticed that his hand was shaking badly.
So what are you saying?
He snapped.
I'm saying we should get out of here before we walk any further into trouble.
Look,
Aveling said as the torchlight suddenly came to rest on something on the floor, 10 or 12 meters further down the tunnel.
That's a body.
It was too big to be a child.
I think that might be Barton, Augur said, with a kind of hopeless inevitability. I think that might be Barton, and I think he might be dead.
Not possible,
Aveling said. He pulled free from her grip and moved further ahead, taking the torch with him. The light bobbed down the tunnel until Aveling reached the body. He knelt and inspected the dead man, the gun still shaking in his grip.
This is bad, he muttered.
Augur forced herself to join him by the body. Up close, there was no doubt that it was Barton. Aveling played the torch over the corpse, lingering over a cluster of bullet holes in the man's chest. There must have been 20 individual wounds, overlapping like lunar craters. They were tightly spaced, as if they had been fired in rapid succession at close range. His fingers were still curled lightly around the grip of another automatic. Augur pulled the gun free. Barton's hand was still warm.
Now let's get out of here, she said.
Aveling's arm jerked as he squeezed off another 2 shots into the darkness. In the muzzle flash, Augur thought she saw something as well, a small doll-like figure scurrying along close to the rough-hewn tunnel wall. The child-sized figure wore a red dress, but the face she had seen in the instant of the flash had not been that of a child at all, but something wizened and feral, half-hag, half-ghoul, with a vile grin full of sharp, blackened teeth. The automatic felt heavy in her hands as she pointed it into the darkness and tried to aim at the spot where she thought the scurrying figure would be by now. She clicked the trigger, but nothing happened. Cursing her stupidity, she fumbled for the safety catch and tried again, but Barton must have already emptied the clip.
We're in a lot of trouble,
Aveling said. He stood up, keeping his knees bent in a crouch, and began to back away from the body.
I definitely saw something that time, Auger said, still holding the gun. It looked like a child. But when I saw the face...
It wasn't a child, Aveling said.
You were expecting something, weren't you?
Go to the top of the class.
Useless as it was, she couldn't help but press the muzzle of the empty automatic against him.
Start talking to me, you pig!
That was not the word she'd had in mind, but pig was the worst she could bring herself to utter, even under these stressful circumstances.
The child's from E1, isn't she?
What makes you say that?
Because whatever it is doesn't belong here. Now tell me what you know.
It's an NI infiltration unit,
Aveling said heavily. He danced the torch beam around the walls, but there was no sign of the child.
A what?
Oh, come on, Orga. Surely you remember that nasty little war we don't like to talk about nowadays, against our friends in the Federation of Polities.
What about it?
They sent their children against us. The Neotenic Infantry. Genetically engineered, cloned, psychologically programmed killing machines, packaged to look like children.
Despite herself, she couldn't help but be moved by the horror she heard in his voice. Anything that left that kind of a scar on a man like Aveling, she thought, had to be bad news. Did you fight against them? She asked.
I engaged them. It's not always the same thing. Those vicious little creatures could crawl into spaces we thought were secure and hide for weeks, somehow surviving on zero rations. Silent, waiting like coiled snakes, almost in a coma, until they emerged.
His breathing was becoming ragged as he slipped deeper into memories.
They were difficult to kill. Fast, strong, wound tolerant. Pain threshold off the scale. Highly attuned sense of self-preservation, and yet perfectly willing to die to serve a mission objective. And even when we knew what they were, even when we had a clear line of sight, it was almost impossible to turn our weapons on them. They looked like children. We were fighting 4 billion years of evolution, telling us we shouldn't squeeze that trigger.
War babies,
Auger said. That was what we called them, wasn't it?
So you do remember your history.
His mocking tone did nothing to disguise his fear. She thought back to Cassandra, the slasher representative who had passed as an adolescent on the mission that had got her into this mess in the first place. The Neotenic Infantry had been a step towards the emergence of entire factions of child-sized slashers, but it had also been a step that no one liked to talk about now, least of all the slashers. I remember that they were a genetic dead end. They didn't work out well. They were mentally unstable and they wore out fast.
They were weapons, Aveling said, designed with a specific shelf life.
But no one's seen any war babies for 20-30 years, Aveling. Please tell me what one is doing in a tunnel under Paris in E2.
Figure it out for yourself, Auger. The slashers are here. They already have a presence in E2.
Suddenly she felt very cold and very scared, and very far from home. We have to get back to the surface.
No,
Aveling said, regaining some of his nerve.
We must get to the portal. The portal absolutely cannot be compromised.
It must already be compromised if they're here. How else did they arrive? Aveling started to say something, but seemed to have trouble getting his words out. He made a phlegmy choking sound and fell heavily against Auger, torch and gun dropping to the floor. Auger drew breath in to scream. It was a natural human reaction, given that the person next to her had just been killed. But somehow she held it in. Shaking, concentrating on acting rather than thinking, she reached for the torch and replaced Barton's useless automatic with the one Aveling had been carrying. Keeping low, she shone the torch down the shaft, and by some accident managed to pin the child to the wall with the fat circle of the beam. The light paralyzed the child for a moment. It looked at her with its horrid, shriveled travesty of a face, wrinkled and bloodless lips framing a devilish, broken-toothed grin. They wore out fast. A dry, black tongue moved between the lips. In its tiny claw of a hand, it held what she assumed was a gun, which it raised towards Auger. She fired first, aiming the automatic in the general direction of the child. The weapon kicked violently back against her palm as it discharged.
Orga let out a small, anguished yelp of pain and surprise as the child creased in the middle and fell out of the spotlight cast by the torch. Its weapon clattered to the ground, and the child let out a vile, draining shriek like steam escaping from a boiling kettle. Every instinct told Orga to run back the way she had come, back to daylight. She knew that there might be more of these creatures in the tunnel, but she had to see what she had killed or maimed. She walked up to it, the gun still heavy in her hand, trusting that there was at least one more bullet in the magazine, but preferring not to know for sure. The child's shrieking was dying away, becoming a faint, almost rhythmic moan. She kicked the child's weapon away and knelt down next to the body. The mop of black hair on top of the creature's head had slipped to one side, exposing a wrinkled, age-spotted skull, pale and hairless. Up close, in the unforgiving light of the torch, the child's face was all sagging folds and bruised welts. It looked like perished rubber beneath a cracking layer of smudged makeup. The eyes were a roomy shade of yellow. The teeth were rotten black stubs behind which the swollen black mass of a diseased tongue moved like some imprisoned monster, attempting to form coherent sounds between each wheezing moan. The child had a disgusting smell about it, like the recesses of an institutional kitchen. "What are you doing here?" Orga asked. In rasps, the child answered,
"You don't need to know."
"I know what you are. You're a military abomination, something that should have been wiped out decades ago. The question is, why weren't you?" Mouthfuls of fluid spilled through the broken portcullis of the child's teeth.
"We got lucky,"
the child said, gurgling with what was either a slow choking death or mocking laughter. "You call this lucky?" Orga asked, nodding towards the wound she had put in the child's stomach.
"I've done what I was put here to do,"
the child said.
"I call that lucky."
Then it died, its head lolling back suddenly, and its eyes freezing in their sockets. Orga reached out in the darkness, feeling here and there until her hand closed around the weapon that the child had carried. She was expecting another automatic, another E2 artifact, at the very least, but the shape of the thing felt unfamiliar and alien. Standing up, she slipped the child's gun into her handbag and stepped away from the corpse. She heard sounds behind her, frantic scraping and rustling noises. She whipped the torch around, expecting to see rats. Instead, she picked out a boy and a girl crouched near Aveling's body. They were rummaging in his clothes. As the light fell on them, they looked at her and hissed in anger. "Get away from him," she said, pointing the automatic. "I've already killed one of you, and I'll kill the rest of you if I have to." The boy flashed his teeth at her, pulling the wad of papers from Aveling's jacket. He was completely bald, like a miniaturized version of an old man.
"Thank you," he said nastily. "We can't have this falling into the wrong hands, can we?"
"Drop the papers," Orga ordered. The girl snarled something at the boy. She had something in one hand as well, glinting silver. She pointed it in Orga's direction, but Orga fired first, the automatic dancing in her hand as she discharged three rounds. The boy hissed and dropped the papers. The girl made another angry sound and snatched the papers from the ground. But as the torchlight played over her, Orga saw that she had hit the girl as well, more by luck than skill, certainly. "Drop the papers," she said again. The girl pulled away from the circle of torchlight. The boy moaned, pawing at a star-shaped wound in his thigh. There was something horrible and dog-like about his movements, as if he did not quite grasp the significance of his injury. He tried to stand, but his injured leg buckled under him in a way legs were never meant to buckle. The boy let out a high-pitched shriek of anger and pain. He reached into his little schoolboy blazer and began to pull out something metallic. Orga shot him again, this time putting a bullet through his chest. He stopped moving. She waved the torchlight down the tunnel, but there was no sign of the girl. Shocked and breathless, Orga stumbled after her until she saw something fluttering on the ground. She picked it up, recognizing one of the documents she had just given to Aveling. There was no sign that the girl had dropped anything else. Orga jammed the paper inside her own coat, making a mental note to examine it later, if she survived that long. She returned to the boy, made sure that he was dead, and then did the same for Aveling, shining the torch into his face until she was certain that there would be no reaction. She heard movement further down the shaft, a dragging sound.
Crouching low, she held the automatic at arm's length and tried to locate the source of the sound with the torch.
Orga?
The female voice was weak and hoarse.
Who is it? Skelskart, thank God you're still alive.
A short figure emerged from the darkness, using the wall of the tunnel for support. One leg was a stiff, bloodied mass, flesh the texture of raw hamburger visible through the ribbons of her trousers. Seeing the state Skelskart was in, Orga caught her breath. She lowered the muzzle of the automatic, but didn't put it away.
You're in a bad way, Orga said.
I'm lucky, Skelskart said with a defiant scowl. They thought I was dead. If they'd had any doubts, they'd have finished the job properly. Stay where you are. We have to get you back to the portal.
Portal isn't safe.
It's got to be safer than this tunnel. Orga pushed herself to her full height, then quickly covered the distance to the injured woman.
Oh, gosh, look at you, she said. Like I said, I'm the lucky one.
Her voice was like two pieces of sandpaper rubbing against each other. She had ripped one of her sleeves off and used it as a makeshift tourniquet around her upper thigh, just below the groin.
I was bleeding badly, but I don't think they hit anything vital.
You need help, and not the kind you're going to get on E2. Orga looked around, suddenly disorientated.
Do you think they've all gone?
There were three of them.
I killed two. The third must have got away.
Orga thumbed the automatic safety catch on and slipped the gun into her waistband. It jabbed painfully into her side, but she wanted it where she could get hold of it quickly if she needed to.
Here, lean against me. How far is it to the sensor?
About 50 meters back that way.
She gestured vaguely behind her with a toss of her head.
Can you make it?
Skelskart transferred her weight to Orga.
I can try. Tell me what happened. I need to know everything.
I can only tell you what I know.
That'll do for now.
What did you get from Eveling?
Not very much, Orga said.
They were making slow progress, with Skelskard's movements restricted to small, agonized hops.
Orga didn't want to think about the pain she must be experiencing from her shredded leg. Eveling knew more than I did, obviously. I got the distinct impression that he knew there were slasher elements already here. What I don't know is whether or not he knew how they'd got here.
We had suspicions, Skelskart said, but this is the first clear look we've had at them.
You want to hazard a guess as to how they got here?
There's only one way into E2, Skelskart said. We're sure of that. It's our portal, and it's been under our absolute control since we opened it. Anything foreign in E2 has to have come through the portal, and it has to have passed through the sensor.
So I was told, Orga said, but that didn't stop these things.
War babies are biotechnological weapons, sure, but there's nothing mechanical about them. Nothing that the sensor should have rejected. I can't believe they got through somehow or other.
Recently?
No,
Skelskart said. There's no way those children came through while we've been running the portal. Slasher agents might have penetrated our security, might even have passed themselves off as threshers, but children, I think we'd have noticed.
They got here somehow. If the portal's the only way in, that's how they must have arrived.
Then there's only one explanation, Skelskart said. Do you mind if I stop for a moment? I need to rest. Be my guest.
Skelskart paused for a minute before speaking again, keeping her eyes closed for much of that time.
They can't have come through the portal while we've been running it, which leaves only one possibility. They must have come through before that.
She screwed up her face, her eyes watering. Orga guessed that shock must be setting in.
Do you have any idea when? She asked gently.
Mars has been under our control for around 23 years, ever since the armistice. We didn't discover the portal until 2 years ago, but that doesn't mean anyone else could have been secretly using it during all those years. We'd have noticed something going on, just a power drain required to keep the portal open. But clearly someone did use it.
In which case, it must have happened more than 23 years ago. Just before the armistice, there was a period when Mars and its moons were under Slasher authority. It didn't last very long. About 18 months, give or take.
You're saying those war babies have been in Paris for 23 years?
It's the only explanation I can think of. Any Slasher agents on E2 would have been stranded here once Mars was handed back to us. Actually, that would explain a lot. War babies were infertile, and they were never meant to grow old.
Aveling said something about a shelf life.
They were supposed to be decommissioned before senescence set in. Gotta love those slasher euphemisms. But these war babies have been left to grow old on their own. That's why they look the way they do. So what have they been doing all this time?
That's a very good question.
Can you move again? Olga said. I think we need to be on our way. Skalskard granted an agreement and resumed her hopping progress.
We lost control of Susan White, she said, between ragged breaths. One explanation is that she was working for the enemy. Having known Susan, I don't think that's very likely.
I don't think it's very likely either. I'm more inclined to believe that she figured out part of what was going on here, that there was already a slasher presence on E2.
Did she report this back to Kalaskan?
Skalskard shook her head.
No. I think she must have been worried about blowing her own cover. She may not have been working for the enemy, but she might have had her doubts about someone else on the team.
I sort of arrived at the same conclusion, Auger said cautiously.
Really?
Yes, Auger said. Why bring me into the operation, unless she was unwilling to trust an insider to get the job done?
I think you could be right.
It means I have to make a decision about who to trust. With Aveling and Barton, it's not exactly an issue anymore. That leaves you, Moria.
Ent,
I don't know what Susan thought about you. For better or worse, I don't think I have much choice but to trust you.
But that's a resounding vote of confidence.
Sorry, I meant it to sound a bit more positive than that. Not that it makes much difference, now that the papers are gone.
But you looked at him, right?
Glanced through them, Auger said.
Better than nothing. At least you have some idea about what was worth killing for. If we can get that news back to Kalaskan, maybe he can put the pieces together.
And if Kalaskan is the problem?
All Susan's letters were addressed to him, Skalskard said,
right until the end. That suggests she still trusted him, even if she had her doubts about everyone else.
Maybe. We have to start somewhere.
Agreed, I suppose.
But can we get a message through to him?
Aveling told me there were problems with the link.
There are always problems, Skalskard replied. It's just got a lot worse since you arrived. Did you hear about the shitstorm brewing back home?
Aveling said that the polities are stirring up trouble.
It's worse than that. We've got a full-scale civil war in polity space, between the moderates and the aggressors. No one's putting any money on who's going to win that particular catfight. Meanwhile, the aggressors are moving their assets deep into the inner system, into Usni space.
Doesn't that constitute a declaration of war?
It would, if the Usni wasn't so afraid of fighting back. At the moment, our politicians are just making a lot of exasperated noises and hoping the moderates will rein in the aggressors.
And?
Be nice if it happens.
I'm worried about my kids, Moria. I need to be back there taking care of them. If the aggressors move on Tanglewood.
It's all right. We heard from your ex just before the link went tits up. He wanted you to know that he'll make sure your kids are safe.
He'd better, Auger replied.
Jesus, kid. He's only trying to reassure you. Cut the guy some slack.
Auger ignored her. Tell me about the link. What exactly is the problem?
Problem is, our friends from the polities are a little too close to Mars for comfort. They know about link technology, of course. They already have the sensors to detect and localize active portals. If they even have a whisper of intelligence about there being a link around Mars, they'll be looking for it. Consequently, we're having to run the link as quietly as we can, and that's why it keeps going down.
They must know about it already. How else could the children have got here?
But when we took Phobos off him, there was no sign that they'd ever discovered the portal.
Maybe, Auger said, that was just what they wanted you to think.
They had reached the heavy iron door that led to the sensor chamber. It was ajar, a bright septic yellow light spilling through from beyond.
It's as I left it, Skalskard observed.
Best not to take anything for granted all the same.
Wait here a moment.
Auger propped Skalskard up against the wall and pulled the automatic from her waistband, praying that there was still at least one bullet inside it. She stepped over the metal lip of the door, squeezing through the gap into the room beyond, and whipped the gun from corner to corner as fast as she could.
No children, at least none that she could see.
She helped Skalskard into the room, then heaved shut the iron door. Together they spun the heavy duty lock. The door could only be unlocked from the inside.
How are you doing? Auger asked.
Not too good. I think I need to loosen this tourniquet.
Let's get you through the sensor first. The bright yellow barrier of the sensor was the only source of light in the room. It flickered in Auger's peripheral vision, but when she looked at it directly,
It remained completely unwavering. Fused into the rock around it, the framework machinery looked intact, as thoroughly ancient and alien as the last time she had seen it. "I'm going to go ahead first and check," Augur said. "I'll be back in a few seconds."
"Or not,"
Skarsgård said. "If I don't come back, if there's something waiting for me on the other side, then you'll have to take your chances on E2. Skarsgård shivered. "I'd sooner take my chances in the Stone Age. They're not that bad. They do have anesthetic, plus some rudimentary knowledge of sterilization. If you can get yourself taken to a hospital, you'll have a pretty good chance of being looked after.
And then?
When they start asking awkward questions?
Then you're on your own,"
Augur said. "I'd rather risk the sensor. Let me go first, will you? I'm already hurt, and there's no point two of us taking an unnecessary risk. If things are okay, I'll poke my head back through to let you know."
"Take this," Augur said, offering her the automatic.
"You fired this thing?"
"Yes, and I can't promise that there are any bullets left in it."
She helped Skarsgård to the sensor, then stood back as the injured woman supported her weight from the overhead rail and, with a grunt of effort and discomfort, succeeded in picking up sufficient momentum to swing herself over the threshold. The bright yellow surface puckered inward, darkening to a bruised shade of golden brown, then swallowed her completely before twanging back to its intact state. Augur waited, delving into her handbag for the weapon she had taken from the war baby. It was designed for a smaller hand than hers, but she could still grip it, even if it felt uncomfortable. It was made of metal and was very light compared with the automatic, but it was still a gun. There was a trigger and a trigger guard, and a sliding button that she figured was the safety catch. There was a perforated barrel with a hole in the end, and a complex hinged loading mechanism that swung out from one side. The gun was machined from curved, sleekly interlocking parts, and she suspected that it could also be reconfigured for throwing or stabbing if circumstances demanded. It didn't look like something she would have expected to find in an E2 gunsmith's workshop, but neither was it 23rd century condensed energy technology from the Slasher Armaments works in E1 space. As foreign as it looked, it was something that could conceivably have been made in E2 Paris, using local technology. Something was pushing through the yellow surface. Skarsgård's face emerged with a pop of breaking surface tension.
"It's safe," she said.
Augur disabled the weapon's safety catch and followed the other woman through the tingling barrier of the sensor. Just before it swallowed her, she had time to remember Skarsgård's story of the endless yellow limbo she had once experienced during the passage through the sensor. That sense of being scrutinized by minds as ancient and huge as mountains. Augur braced herself, some part of her wanting that experience, another fearing it with every atom of her existence. But the moment of transition was as brief as the first time. As before, she felt a mild, elastic resistance that suddenly abated, as if she had burst through the skin of a drum. There had been no audience with God, or whatever godlike entities had created the sensor and the duplicate Earth, nor had any part of her been refused passage. Her clothes and the gun she carried were still with her when she entered the portal chamber. The sensor's implacable logic had decided to allow those simple things through. Or perhaps it was much less concerned with artifacts escaping E2 than entering it.
"No one's come through," Skarsgård said.
She was leaning against a console, her face a pallid mask of exhaustion and shock.
"No sign of any children?"
"I don't think they made it this far. Fucking lucky that they didn't. Or they might have done something irreversible to the link, or turned the far end into a temporary white hole, adios Phobos, and anything near it. Let's take a look at your leg."
"I've adjusted the tourniquet. I'll be okay for a while."
Augur snapped a first aid kit from its wall mounting. She fumbled the plastic catches open and rummaged through the contents until she found a morphine jab.
"Can you do this yourself?"
she asked, passing the syringe to Skarsgård.
"I'm not too good with needles."
"I'll manage." Skarsgård bit the sterile wrapper from the syringe, then jammed the needle into her thigh, just above the wound but below the tourniquet.
"I don't know if this is the right thing to do," she said. "Guess I'll find out sooner or later."
"We have to get the link up and running," Augur said. "Can we do it together?"
"Give me a moment."
She nodded at one of the desks down on the machine floor. "In the meantime, go down to that console and throw all the switches on the top bank to their red settings.
then see if any of the dials stay into green. It's that simple. One step at a time, sister. We're not cooking with gas here. We're dealing with major alterations to the local space-time metric. My will's already up to date, Augur said. She removed her shoes and made her way down the spiral access ladder as quickly as she could. She had never been down to the machine floor before, and the scale of the equipment looming around her and over her was dauntingly impressive. Fortunately, it all looked intact. The transit craft was suspended overhead in the vacuum-filled recovery bubble, clutched in the B-striped cradle, its blunt, stress-battered nose still aimed away from the mirror-lined shaft of the portal tunnel. Once they'd turned it around, all they needed was a moment of stability from the link. She made her way to the console Skelskad had indicated and flipped the heavy-duty toggle switches one by one. The dials quivered, but although one or two needles continued to hover in the red for a few moments, they eventually sank back into the green. "We're looking good," Augur said. Skelskad had dragged herself to the railed edge of the upper catwalk and was looking down on Augur. "All right, that's better than I expected. Now see that second bank of switches under the hinged plastic hood? Got it. Lift your hood and start flipping them as well, and keep an eye on the dials. If more than two of them twitch into the red and stay there, stop flipping. Why do I have the impression that this is the tricky bit?" "It's all tricky," Skelskad said. Augur began to flip the second set of toggles, slower this time, letting the dial above each switch twitch and settle before advancing to the next. Around her, with each switch that she threw, the machinery notched up its humming presence. Red and green status lights began to blink on items of equipment halfway across the floor, and even in the recovery bubble itself. "I'm halfway there," Augur said. "So far, so good. Will the ship fly itself?" "One step at a time. We'll prep the ship once we've established throat curvature. Getting goose pimples yet?" "Not yet." "You should be." Augur threw another switch. "Whoa, wait," she said. "We're holding in the red on the fifth dial." "That's what I was worried about. All right, reverse the last switch you flicked. See if that helps." Augur did as she was told. "Back in the green," she said after a few seconds. "Try it again." "Still in the red. Reversing and trying again." Augur waited, biting her tongue. "Sorry. No joy. What does that mean?" "It means we have a problem." "All right. Leave that be and move to the second console, the one with the toolkit next to it." "Got it. Throw the red switch on the right-hand side of the monitor and tell me what kind of numbers come up in the third column of the readout." Augur scraped dust from the glass. 15.173, 13.04. "Roughly, Augur. I don't need decimal precision here. They're all between 10 and 20. "Shit. That's not good. Stability's still compromised. Can we get home?" "Not easily." Augur turned from the console and looked up at Skelskad. "What if we wait? Will things get better?" "They might do. Then again, they might get worse. And there's no telling how long this instability will last. Could be hours, could be tens of hours or even days. We can't wait that long. Not when more of those kids might show up at any moment. When you say not easily, what does that mean? That there is a way?" "There's a way," Skelskad said, "for one of us." "I don't follow." "We'll need to stabilize the throat geometry at this end, and that's going to cost us more power than we can supply in the long term." Augur shrugged. "Doesn't matter. I don't care if the link folds once we're out of here." Skelskad shook her head. "Not that simple. Look, I don't want to give you a lecture on hypervacuum theory. Suits me fine." Skelskad smiled. "The essential point is that the local throat has to stay open until we reach the far end. Things will get messy if it snaps shut, and they get really, really messy if it snaps shut violently. We'll run the risk of losing the link, for a start, and while the closure might be a relatively low-energy event, as seen from the Paris end, all the energy released by the tunnel collapse will find its way to the Phobos end. It's like stretching a big elastic band between your hands, and then letting go of one end. You get the picture. And even if the collapse isn't violent enough to bring down the link, we'll still be surfing a major stress wave in the transport. We'd have a soliton chasing us all the way home." "What's a soliton?" "Like a rock in a carpet, only with a seriously pissed-off attitude." "That's all I need to know. Now tell me what we can do about it.
Can we stop the throat snapping shut?
Yes,
Skelskad said. Once the ship's cleared the throat, the power can be ramped down to a level the generators can't sustain until the ship gets home. Doesn't sound too complicated to me.
It isn't.
The problem is that it isn't a procedure we ever got around to automating. It was always assumed that we'd have a team here, or that we could hang around indefinitely until stability improved.
I see,
Auger said quietly.
Well, you'd better show me what to do.
No way, Skelskad said. No disrespect, Auger, but this isn't exactly the kind of thing they teach you in history school. You're getting in the ship. I'll handle the throat. What about the children? They didn't get in here before. I'm pretty sure I'll be safe until a rescue party gets through.
But that will take days, Auger said.
About 60 hours, if they can do an immediate turnaround on the ship, and if stability conditions are optimal. Longer if they're not.
I'm not leaving you here.
I can hold out, Skelskad said. You're the one with the critical information, not me.
I lost almost all the information in the tunnel.
But you saw it. That has to be worth something. Auger left the console and sprinted back up the ladder to Skelskad. What exactly is involved in controlling the throat?
It's a very technically demanding procedure.
It can't be that technically demanding, or you'd already have automated it. Talk to me, Skelskad.
She blinked. It's a question of waiting 40 seconds after departure, then dropping power levels to about 10%, using those switches you've already shown me.
More or less. I think even a lowly history grunt can handle that.
All right, let's start prepping the ship. You can tell me the rest while we do it.
That is not the way we're doing this, Skelskad said.
Listen to me. If you don't get medical attention for that leg, you're going to lose it.
So they'll grow me a new one. I always fancied a ride out to one of those quality hospitals.
You want to take that chance?
I don't think I would, especially with all hell breaking loose back home.
I can't let you do this, Skelskad insisted.
Auger took out the war baby's weapon and flashed it at Skelskad. You want me to start pointing this at you? Because believe me, I will. Now let's prep the ship, sister.